Welcome to Dishing the Science with Dr. Sue. I'm your host, Dr. Sue Peterson. I'm a Canadian physician, a specialist in endocrinology and metabolism, and a diplomat of the American Board of Obesity Medicine. I draw on my over 20 years of clinical experience and my extensive research background to examine the complex issues surrounding weight management, diabetes, and overall health. Thanks for joining us today. Hi, everyone, and thanks for joining me on drsue.ca. That's drsue.ca. Today we're talking about how to determine fair allocation of GLP-1 based medications during the global shortages. As the word about the efficacy of new and emerging obesity and diabetes medications continue to spread, the global shortages of these medications continues. The medications we are talking about here are semaglutide, which is Wegovy for weight management, Ozempic for diabetes, and tirzepatide, which is Zepbound for obesity and Mounjaro for diabetes. In many countries, Ozempic and Mounjaro, which are the diabetes brands, have been available, but Wegovy and Zepbound, which are the weight management brands, have not. So doctors have been prescribing Ozempic and or Mounjaro for weight management. As blogged previously, and there's a link to that really important blog post in my blog today, some countries have responded by allowing access only to people with type 2 diabetes and denying access to people with obesity who don't have diabetes. A perspective article in the New England Journal of Medicine suggests a different approach. Authors propose a, quote, fair allocation framework as to who should be prescribed these medications first during times of shortage. They suggest four tiers of priority for who should get medication. The first tier has an objective of minimizing potential years of life lost by preventing excess and premature death. In this tier is included people with a body mass index of 40 or greater, or people with severe, quote, type 2 diabetes defined by an A1C of over 8% whose disease hasn't responded to alternative treatment. The second tier has an objective of preventing imminent medical complications such as cardiovascular events. This is meant to include people with a BMI of 35 to 40, followed by people with, quote, severe type 2 diabetes A1C over 8%. The third tier objective is to prevent future medical complications such as cardiovascular events. And they include here people with a BMI of 30 to 35, followed by people with type 2 diabetes with an A1C or diabetes report card above 7%, whose disease hasn't responded to alternative treatment. And then their fourth and final tier has an objective of improving quality of life and social and emotional health. And here they include people with a BMI of 25 to 30, or people with type 2 diabetes and an A1C of over 7 who aren't eligible under another tier. All four tiers are further broken down into two phases to prioritize younger patients first. So they define the first phase as priority to younger patients, for example, less than 50 years, and phase two for older patients. In tiers 2 to 4, they suggest putting priority on obesity before diabetes, as treating obesity offers the opportunity to prevent or delay diabetes, and because many other treatments for diabetes exist, whereas the choices for obesity medication are few. The authors are also in favor of exempting existing users from this tiered system, in other words, not taking away treatment for those already on treatment, and I was happy to see that. Now, while I'm appreciative that authors are suggesting a paradigm that embraces that obesity is a chronic disease and should not be put in second place behind diabetes for need of treatment, I have concerns about the tiers they have suggested. First of all, BMI is not a marker of the severity of the disease of obesity. BMI is simply a calculation based on weight and height. It's the body mass index. So one person with a BMI of 42 may be quite healthy overall, while the next person with a BMI of 32 might be struggling with sleep apnea, fatty liver disease with scarring or fibrosis, and hypertension, just as examples. Severity of obesity is defined by the health complications associated with elevated weight and how elevated weight is impacting that person's well-being and quality of life. In our Canadian Obesity Clinical Practice Guidelines, and there's a link to that in my blog post today, the Edmonton Obesity Staging System is suggested to determine the severity of obesity and guide clinical decision making. It's called the EOSS for short. This is a measure of the mental, metabolic, and physical impact that obesity has on the person's health and uses these factors to determine their stage of obesity from stage 0 to stage 4. And there's a table right in the guidelines chapter. Link is in my blog. As regards the A1C or diabetes control criteria, it's true that a higher A1C is associated with a higher risk of complications over time. However, the severity of diabetes is not determined by A1C, but rather by the burden of health complications related to diabetes. Further, the health benefits outside of blood sugar control from the GLP-1 receptor agonists are in part independent of glucose control. For example, reduction in heart attack and stroke risk, and more on that in just a minute. Thirdly, both the BMI and A1C criteria effectively punish people who are having some success to control weight or A1C by way of their dedication and hard work on their health because their BMI or A1C aren't, quote, high enough to get into a higher tier of priority. The conclusion could be, well, does this mean if I gain 15 pounds more or stop my insulin to get my A1C higher, then maybe I can get access to the GLP-1 medication? This is clearly unacceptable. I also take issue to the objectives of each tier. These objectives assume that a higher BMI is the obesity metric that should be used to define how sick or how high a health risk that person has. Again, I come back to how heterogeneous the disease of obesity is. Some people with a BMI, for example, 29, 31, present with obesity-related health issues that are much more advanced and would put them squarely within the tier 1 objective, than other people who have a BMI of, let's say, 40 or higher, but don't yet have much obesity-related disease. These criteria also don't take into account whether a person already has cardiovascular disease. Several GLP-1-based medications have shown the capacity to reduce cardiovascular events in people with type 2 diabetes, including semaglutide, which is Ozempic, liraglutide, which is Victoza, and dulaglutide, which is Trulicity, and Wegovy has shown the capacity to reduce cardiovascular event risk by 20% in people with CV disease and obesity without diabetes. People with existing CV disease are at the highest risk of having another heart attack or stroke, and yet there's no priority set for these people to have higher priority of access to medication. Access being granted to younger people before older people is a strategy that authors suggest, with the thinking that intervening in a younger person's life will improve their health starting earlier, giving them a longer number of healthier years. I can see some logic in this one, but at the same time, I don't want to deprive my 50-plus patients from access due to yet another numerical stratification. This is kind of where I throw my hands up in frustration, because the unfortunate reality is that there is no perfect way to fairly allocate this restricted resource. So the bottom line here is that the global shortage of GLP-1-based medications presents major challenges for people and their healthcare providers who need or already depend on these medications to improve, manage, and/or maintain health. It's really difficult to figure out who should get priority for new prescriptions when demand so drastically outstrips the supply. I and authors of the New England Journal article sit strongly in the camp that obesity and diabetes are both chronic diseases that need treatment. If priorities must be set for who gets higher priority for a new start, stratification should be geared more towards people who have a greater burden of health issues related to weight or diabetes that could benefit from these medications, and not by a set of numbers. As supply catches up with demand, and as other new highly effective medications hopefully enter the market coming soon, I look really forward to the supply issue being put firmly in the past. As a disclaimer, I receive honoraria as a continuing medical education speaker and consultant from the maker of semaglutide and liraglutide, which is Novo Nordisk, and tirzepatide and dulaglutide, which is Eli Lilly. I am and or have been an investigator in clinical trials of semaglutide, tirzepatide, and liraglutide. That's all for today. Thanks for listening, drsue.ca. Thanks for listening to Dishing the Science with Dr. Sue. For more information about current hot topics and science relating to obesity, diabetes, and overall health, check out the show notes for links and visit drsue.ca. That's drsue.ca. Don't forget to leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite listening platforms. Medical discussion on this podcast is of a general nature only, not designed to give specific medical advice to individuals nor their individual healthcare providers, and is intended for a Canadian audience.